Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Memphis Commercial Appeal reporter Mark Parascia, a features and investigative journalist. An offhand remark in a 1997 background interview with a retired FBI agent was the start of an off-and-on investigation into an amazing story. His book, A Spy in Canaan, tells the story of how one of the most acclaimed photographers of the civil rights era, a friend and confidant of Martin Luther King and a score of other civil rights leaders, was also working as a confidential informer for the FBI. Ernest Withers took many iconic photographs throughout the civil rights era, from Emmett Till's uncle pointing at his nephew's killers in a Mississippi courtroom to Martin Luther King's first ride on an integrated Birmingham bus to King relaxing on a motel bed at Memphis's Lorraine Motel. But he was also reporting what he heard and sending his photographs to an FBI contact. Parascia tells the story of Withers and the fight with the FBI to bring this information to light in the book A Spy in Canaan, how the FBI used a famous photographer to infiltrate the civil rights movement. It's published by Melville House, and he joins me today as my guest on Studio Tulsa. Mark Parascia, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rich.
You know, last week as the world commemorated the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, there were several images of those last days in Memphis, and one was of a group of striking sanitation workers literally shoulder to shoulder walking down the street holding the sign, "I am a man." Now, the man who took that picture was a confidant of Martin Luther King, the leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and a host of civil rights organizations. But he also led a double life, which you detail in your book, A Spy in Canaan. Who was that man, and why is he important?
Ernest Withers was probably, you know, the biggest name in photography you never heard of in the 1960s in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. He took some of the biggest pictures of the movement, some of these iconic photos that probably resonate in the back of your mind, even though Ernest Withers is not a household name. He covered Emmett Till's trial and the dawn of the movement in 1955, and he was here when in Memphis, his hometown, when Dr. King was shot in 1968, and covered that as well. He took some of the haunting pictures that he took were Emmett Till's great uncle Mose Wright in court on the witness stand, pointing an accusing finger at the killers, the two white men who actually got away with killing Emmett Till. But you know, Ernest actually defied a judge's order forbidding any pictures during court session and took this very powerful picture off from the side of Moses Wright, and it's just a really haunting portrait. He was there when Dr. King rode one of the first integrated buses in Montgomery, took this beautiful picture of Dr. King up near the front of the bus and a whole sea load of white faces behind him, a very revolutionary moment. But he, on and on and on throughout the movement, he did things like this. I mean, he covered the Little Rock Nine and Little Rock, the integration of Central High there in 1957, the integration of Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi in 1962, and the assassination of Medgar Evers in 1963, on through to, you know, the 68 sanitation strike here in Memphis and beyond.
Yet, at the same time, he was, as I mentioned, leading a double life. He was also serving as an FBI informant.
Right. Ernest's role with the FBI is something that we first broke. I did here at the Commercial Appeal, the daily newspaper in Memphis, as part of a running newspaper investigation in 2010. It was something that, you know, was hidden and not known. And it's a really fascinating story in that this hidden history says so much about the paranoia of the time and what the government was doing, because the government, the FBI, and working in tandem with the police department here in Memphis, essentially created a police state. This grew out of the McCarthyism of the 1950s, when it was the Cold War, and you know, this country was obviously, you know, very many people felt this palpable fear of the presence of the Soviet Union and nuclear war and all this stuff hung over this. But you know, as the 50s morphed into the 60s and the movement blossomed, the FBI, led by J. Edgar Hoover, took a very dim view of these movements. He believed that they were communist-influenced, the civil rights movement to a large extent, the peace movement. And they needed people like Ernest Withers to help them police these movements. And so this is what Ernest did pretty much over the course of 18 years, from 1958 to 1976. He was a paid informant. The early years are kind of sketchy about what exactly he was doing from 58 to 61. But certainly in 1961, as the movement really takes root in Memphis, he begins, you know, these files that we got as far as this lawsuit that we had, a Freedom of Information Act suit against the FBI, just flesh this out, how in 61, there were three or four things going on that had the FBI worked up, and one was something called Tent City. It was a rural movement in rural West Tennessee, outside of Memphis, where sharecroppers had been kicked off their land for trying to register to vote, and various relief agencies from the north were coming in to assist these families. There was, you know, the Congress of Racial Equality was one. There were numbers of, you know, initiatives out of Cornell University over the years that sent student civil rights workers down here to help these individuals. All of these efforts were viewed dimly by the government. They felt that, you know, again, there was a lot of communist influence. The potential for subversion, they felt, and agitation was something that they definitely wanted to monitor, and they needed somebody to help them do that. And one key player was Ernest Withers. You know, Withers, what made him different from many people that they wanted to gather intel from was that he had a camera. And so, you know, basically the FBI was indexing these movements. That's one way that Ernest was very valuable to them. They were cataloging, kind of building a secret who's who within the movement. You know, he could give them these identification pictures. He could give them, particularly in Memphis, he knew everybody. He could give them, you know, home addresses, names of associates, family members, where they worked, as they wanted to assemble this, you know, personal and political data on individuals. So you had the Tent City operation here. You also had the Nation of Islam began to appear here in, you know, 1960-61, and they opened a mosque on Beale Street. FBI, again, antenna goes way up. Ernest knows all these guys. So, again, he actually can get into the mosque and give them a bird's eye view with his pictures and his intel and lay a roadmap for them of, you know, who's who do they want to keep an eye on? Who can they, you know, afford to not maybe invest so much effort in? And then, too, you had in 61, you had the Freedom Rides and a lot of these, you know, the effort to integrate public accommodations and interstate transportation through bus and train travel. And, you know, a lot of these individuals were coming back home, you know, some of them having been from Memphis, young students who were viewed, you know, as more militant than your kind of middle of the road, traditional NAACP activist. And so Ernest could help them with all these things.
Now, he held credentials from Jet magazine. He was a freelance photographer, but he did hold credentials from Jet and several black newspapers over the years, and this allowed him entree to a lot of these groups?
Absolutely. And again, it was because of the rapport that he'd built. I mean, he took these very powerful pictures and worked, you know. He worked for the Tri-State Defender as a freelancer. The Tri-State Defender was owned by the Chicago Defender. It was a satellite operation down here in the South. But he also worked with Jet Magazine, and so he got to know some of the huge journalists of the time. He worked closely with Simeon Booker. As a matter of fact, Simeon Booker had, you know, this is kind of interesting. We don't know the full detail of how this relationship, you know, how it blossomed in the beginning, but Simeon Booker had his own relationship with the FBI, and he talked about that late in life. He's passed on recently, but he talked about how he felt he needed protection. This was like the 50s. You know, well before things really got, you know, kind of the innocence of the early days of the movement. And when he went down south, he would tell the FBI where he was going because, as he said, I wanted to come back alive. He didn't trust a lot of these local police departments that were really, you know, in the weeds when it came to, you know, racism and all sorts of things. He, you know, but he had a more favorable impression of the FBI. And so the first time that Ernest ever, you know, shows up in any kind of informing capacity is 1958, in the field office in Little Rock, and he's there with Simeon Booker, and they're talking about James Forman. James Forman being, of course, a huge movement figure who, you know, was later involved with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and, you know, numbers of other efforts, you know, the March in Selma, and, you know, on and on. But in the early days, you know, Forman is just a school teacher from Chicago coming down to the South who shows up at one civil rights skirmish after another in company with leftists from New York, people the FBI view as communists. In fact, one of the writers he was with had written for a time, had been a member of the Communist Party. So they're looking at Foreman as a communist. And so, you know, Booker and Ernest Withers are there in the FBI field office in Little Rock passing on information about Foreman and their views, you know, being very dim of him as well. And so, you know, it appears that in the beginning, Ernest's connection to the FBI could have at least been influenced, perhaps, by Simeon Booker. And, you know, Booker was never accused of being an informer, per se, but he did do kind of like a lot of fluff pieces for the FBI over the years, had this relationship with them. They liked him. And so it could be that Ernest was influenced by that. There were others who, over the years, you know, had been exposed as informers and, you know, mentioned this connection to the FBI as, you know, being a more favorable kind of thing of protection. But over time, then, see, what happens is Ernest gets in deep, and as the movement morphs and things, the times lose their innocence, and there's a lot more unrest. There's a lot of black journalists in the mid to late 60s who are openly defying the FBI for requests for information. But, you know, Ernest was in so deep then, and he stuck with it, you know, all the way through. And, you know, the last records that, you know, they made available in 1975, and supposedly even in the 76, he was still informing for them.
What's really interesting is that it was more than just photographs. He was taking down and relating conversations he overheard or heard. And we have to remember, because he was so ingratiated into the civil rights movement and into various parts of the 1960s movements, he was considered a friend of the movement. It was almost like he was the staff photographer for a lot of the civil rights struggles.
Right. People have said he was the eyes of the movement. Yeah, I mean, and it was those personal relationships that he relied on and would pick up all kinds of information. Like, for example, you know, Reverend James Lawson. Lawson, another huge movement icon, was very close to Dr. King, was, you know, had studied in India and was, you know, was considered like the father of the nonviolent movement, the whole tactic of direct action and, you know, challenging authority through not violent means, but militant means, you know, marching in the streets, sit-ins and that sort of thing. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, Lawson in the early 60s was, you know, very involved and influential in the Nashville movement and the Freedom Rides and all that.
And so, he was later influential in getting Martin Luther King to come out against the Vietnam War.
Absolutely. True? I mean, James Lawson was a conscientious objector who technically never got conscientious objector status and went to prison in the early 50s because of his belief of, you know, pacifism and not wanting to be a part of this, you know, of militarism. And so, yeah, he was a big influence on King. James Lawson, after he was driven out of Vanderbilt for his, you know, involvement in the Freedom Rides and the sit-in movement there, moves to Memphis in 1962, virtually from the day he arrives here. Ernest is reporting on him to Bill Lawrence, his handler in the FBI, saying, you know, here is a potential thorn in the side of the traditional leadership. This goes on and on for the better part of 6-8 years until Lawson left here in 1970 or thereabouts. But I've counted, you know, dozens of instances in which he passed on information, you know, that things from, you know, Lawson is planning a trip to communist Czechoslovakia, or, you know, he's coaching young men in ways to dodge the draft, or, you know, even something, one of the reports was, is that he preached a controversial sermon at his church that questioned the virgin birth of Christ. You know, and you wonder what possible value could something like that have to the FBI. But they were gathering all manner of information on individuals that they viewed dimly, that they believed were subversive. When the Senate committee investigated a lot of these investigations in the 70s, looking back at what was done in the 60s and the 70s, I mean, they talked about this vacuum cleaner approach where, you know, the FBI would just suck up all kinds of stuff on individuals that, you know, some of it seemingly to be worthless, but I mean, with the potential that they, you know, they might use it as leverage if needed, if it came about. But they were doing that with James Lawson and numbers of other people. And some people, you know, were jeopardized by these operations.
That's what one point I wanted to make was that in the book you write, you know, when we think of FBI surveillance from this period, we think of it as being harassing, sometimes pettily harassing, mm-hmm. embarrassing, trying to release embarrassing information about the subjects they're surveilling, or even maybe a blackmail approach. We're going to release this unless you do this. But really, you document in the book some of the conversations that Withers related to the FBI resulted in Memphis State professors losing their jobs, and much like out of the 1950s.
Well, there very much was a kind of a mirroring situation of the McCarthyism, and particularly when the Black Power movement takes root here in 1967 and 68, is that, the FBI was trying to undercut not only the Black Power movement, but sympathizers and supporters and associates, not unlike the McCarthy era. And a good example of that is the case of Bobby Doctor. Bobby Doctor was a civil rights activist who got involved early in South Carolina in 1960 with the sit-in movements, and eventually, in 1965, he went to work for the federal government as a field representative for the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and he was based here in Memphis. By 67, 68, he starts befriending some of the young men who are involved in the blossoming Black Power movement here, and Withers and other informers are picking up this information that here, Bobby Doctor is at this social gathering. He's with Black Power militants. He is seen in social gatherings and other places, with Black Power militants. And so the FBI eventually tries to get him fired from his job, opened up an investigation that originally was opened as a loyalty investigation. That's how the file was coded, and takes a file of his activities up there. He managed to hang on to his job, but, Ernest was in that deeply. And in fact, at one point, Ernest tells Bill Lawrence, his handler at the FBI, that he saw Bobby Doctor at a march holding the hand of a woman who was not his wife. And so Bill Lawrence obviously wants this picture, and Withers gives it to him. The FBI is spending taxpayer dollars investigating the possibility of an extramarital affair, which, why are they doing this? Well, they're trying to undercut this man. They went after his colleague in a similar manner, Rosetta Miller, who they also deemed to be too close to the Black Power movement. And Ernest gave them photos of her and passed on rumors about her personal life. And it was said, after Lawrence debriefed Ernest Withers, said that she is one who will give aid and comfort to the Black Power groups. So pretty insidious stuff.
We should mention Bill Lawrence was the FBI agent that was Withers' contact.
Right.
My guest today is Mark Parascia. He's a journalist with the Memphis Commercial Appeal who broke the story 8 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, 2010 when the initial stories came out.
That's when he broke the story that the civil rights photographer Ernest Withers was actually a confidential informant for the FBI. He's now written a book about this story titled A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. It's published by Melville House, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the book has a sort of two purposes. One, you tell the story of Ernest Withers and what he did for the FBI and the story of his entire life, but you also tell the story of learning the story.
That's right.
And this story started in the fall of 1997 when you talked to another retired FBI agent. You could only get him to go on background.
Right.
And he first revealed this name to you, right?
That's right. In 1997, I was covering hearings for James Earl Ray, Dr. King's convicted assassin. Ray was dying of liver disease and desperately trying to get out of prison. And he and his lawyers were filing all manner of pleadings in the criminal court down here, contending various conspiracies, high-level government conspiracies to kill Dr. King. A lot of this stuff was really far-fetched stuff that had no basis in fact, in my view. But nonetheless, they got quite a lot of traction. The King family came here and endorsed these claims. And as a matter of fact, Dr. King's younger son, Dexter, met Ray in prison and shook his hand and said, we believe you and we will do everything in our power to get you out. It was a very surreal moment, that was national and international news. And it, consequently, my paper otherwise would have not had much interest in covering these things, but gave me a lot of latitude to look into different things. And so I was interviewing, former police officers and FBI agents, military intelligence, and that sort of thing. And that's when I met this retired FBI agent who told me about Ernest Withers and told me, confidentially, and said that if I ever reported it, he would deny it. And I never did anything with it at that time. But it was only years later, after Ernest Withers died in 2007 at age 85, that I did do a Freedom of Information Act request. And that's where I got my first indication that my source all those years earlier was right. And What it was there were some FBI files related to an investigation of Ernest Withers after the civil rights era had waned. He had become essentially a state policeman, a state liquor agent for the state of Tennessee, and got caught up in some corruption. And in that file, there was a background report, and it referred, and the line said, Ernest Columbus Withers was formally designated ME-338-R, which I knew just enough at that point to recognize it as a code number, you know, an FBI number, an informant number. In the business, they actually call it a source symbol number. And eventually, I was able to get other documents that the FBI had released through the Freedom of Information Act related to this late 60s period, and they made the same mistake. They were supposed to redact that code number, but they didn't. And so it's a unique identifier. And so every time you see ME-338-R, you can just substitute in Ernest Withers. And that led to, you know, some stories where I was able to say, you know, specific things that he did for the FBI. And eventually, you know, reached Bill Lawrence's daughter, you know, Bill Lawrence, again, being the FBI agent who ran Ernest Withers. But by then, he had passed on. He'd died 20 years earlier. But I reached his daughter in 2010, and I was very fortunate. I mean, she shared a number of personal facts, including handwritten notes that Lawrence had written that talked about Withers in, you know, by name and by code number. And so that led to more stories. And we eventually, you know, sued the FBI through the Freedom of Information Act. They denied everything, you know, and we had to fight them in court. And the law is such that it protects informant records to the point where the FBI can lie about them and pretend that they don't even exist, which is what they did. It's exactly what they did. It was just a confluence of factors that came together that we had a good case, a good judge, and we were able to beat them at their own game to the point where they had to admit in court he was an informant. They admitted that they'd been lying about it, and they got caught in this lie, and that led to this mediated settlement where they paid virtually all of our attorney's fees back and released these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents and photos that detail what he was doing for the FBI.
You know, and if you know the history of the FBI at this point, Hoover was always interested in King.
Mm-hmm.
But once he came out against the Vietnam War, that escalated greatly.
Absolutely.
And you see this in some of the FBI appeals for information. But it was just not what the FBI would consider threats to the state. He was also informing on, you know, Stax Records was having its heyday in the 1960s in Memphis. He was going, you know, he was photographing R&B stars. He was informing on them, too.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting what he was informing on was he was the FBI, again, they wanted to know, you know, the support mechanism, the supporters, sympathizers, associates, sources of revenue to these quote-unquote extremists, which would include Black Power advocates, and in many cases, the young people who were identifying with the Communist Party. And it's interesting that at that period of time, you're talking late 60s, early 70s, you had a resurgence of the Communist Party here in Memphis. Back in the 50s, Bill Lawrence had totally eviscerated the Communist Party. They virtually ceased to exist. People left the state, and the few who remained were completely underground. But, you know, 1969, 1970, you have the reemergence through what they called the Young Workers Liberation League, which was a communist youth organization that some activists started. And what they're doing is these activists are organizing against the war. They'd also, you know, been here supporting the striking sanitation workers in 68 and were protesting against school segregation, taking on a lot of idealistic causes, no contacts to foreign powers or anything like that the FBI somehow thought they did. But they launched this intensive investigation and were tracking things like that. And Ernest was telling them, you know, Kathy Rupp Hunanen with the Young Workers Liberation League got, you know, X donation here from so-and-so at Stacks and on. It's interesting about Kathy Rupp Hunanen. She believes the FBI, and to a point, Ernest Withers, ruined her life because she lost her entire career. I mean, it really is a heck of a story, but she, because of her affiliation with the Communist Party, was under investigation here for several years to the point that they logged in every divey apartment she ever lived in, every waitressing job she had, every meeting she went on. There's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of intel that they gathered on her. And when she later went to work, she got a PhD at the University of Cincinnati in environmental science and went to work for the federal government in 1986 through the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. They did a routine name check on her and found that the FBI had been conducting this investigation of her, you know, at that point, 10 years earlier, and they fired her. And she got a lawyer and got her job back. She was a probation employee, but then this long process, they wanted to do a full field investigation on her. She fought them on it. She felt it was too intrusive, you know, where they were going to go interview neighbors, friends, associates, on this very embarrassing, humiliating thing. And after a year, she finally just gave it up and quit. So she lost her entire career because of this investigation of her down here in Memphis that the FBI viewed her to be an enemy of the state and a security threat. And it really is a tragic story.
For you as a reporter, is that why this story is important to you?
Because
you know, we're talking about people, for the most part, the people you're writing about, as you were writing about it, they're dead.
A lot of them are. But yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, this is what it's all about. And, you know, Ernest Withers is a hero in Memphis, understandably so. I mean, I've said this many, many times. I mean, he is a legitimate civil rights hero. I'm not trying to destroy his legacy in any way. But there is this hidden history that's very instructive that we need to know about. And he and others were involved in this surveillance state, police state, if you will, that they set up here, and where they were tracking people, monitoring, gathering personal and political data on them that, for many cases, doing nothing more than exercising First Amendment rights to dissent and protest. And I think this story is very instructive about, you know, how corrosive some government practices can be to our democracy, where people aren't really allowed to exercise democratic rights. They are contained from doing it, you know, and sometimes to a very drastic consequence.
What motivated him to inform? Was he put under pressure? I know he'd been dismissed from the Memphis police force some years earlier. Later, he was caught up in a corruption scandal in the state of Tennessee. But what motivated him to inform?
I never found any evidence that he was, you know, flipped, as they say, where somebody who did something illegal was kind of forced, you know, had no choice but to inform. I think it was different with him. I think a primary motivating factor for him was money. He had 8 children to feed. He had a big family, and he always hustled to support his family. He was a good family man, and he was going to take care of his kids. And so this was a revenue option for him. You know, money, of course, was, you know, not the only thing. I think also he was a bit more conservative than a lot of people in the movement, particularly when it came to the peace movement. I mean, Ernest was a World War II veteran. He fought in the Pacific. You know, he had, in the mid to late 60s, he was heavily invested in the military. He had 3 sons in the armed services and 1 in the front lines in Vietnam. So, you know, he was a bit more conservative, and I think that factored in it too. But then the third thing probably is his long ambition to be a cop. And, of course, he was a police officer briefly for the city of Memphis and then later for the state of Tennessee. At one point in the mid-70s, he was even elected constable of Shelby County, which was kind of a nominal law enforcement position. But so, that, you know, those 3 things, I think, were the things that really motivated. But really, money kind of taking the leading role. That in fact, my original source, that's what he said, is that, you know, Ernest was in it for the money.
Mark Parascia, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
Mark Parascia is an investigative journalist and reporter with the Memphis Commercial Appeal and the author of A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. It's published by Melville House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.